And here's what we're going to do. This is Communion Sunday. We're going to look at the roots of communion. Right? And predating what Jesus did, we're going to look right back to Exodus 12, to the Passover. Because the communion that we celebrate, that Jesus instituted, it had its roots way back in the Passover feast. So what we're going to do this morning is quite simple. We're going to look at marks of the Passover feast and how Jesus interpreted them. And then we're going to close our service by taking communion together and having a bit of time to pray together. So that's what we'll be doing. You can turn to Exodus 12 if you want to be ready. I'm not going to read all of it, but I'm going to read portions of it. But the problem with communion is that whenever you do something repeatedly, it can become boring and routine, and you don't even think about what you're doing anymore. Anyone know what this is? In my last church, my good friend, and he's still my friend even after this, Tim, the youth pastor, he's not a morning person. So when he would come to church, he would be pretty groggy in the mornings. He'd usually be out with youth till all hours of the night before, and he'd stumble into church, and he was like a walking zombie. And I don't know how to get you to picture this, but his office was the end of the hall, and my office was just before the end of the hall. So our doors were right beside, basically perpendicular, 90 degrees to each other. And so April Fool's rolled around, and I got it, brought in a screwdriver, and I took off the plate on the door, and I tied one end around the door frame, and then I tied the other end of this. I took a screw out and tied it around the part that latches the door. And then I tucked this in and I closed his door, and it looked like a normal door. So Tim came in that morning, groggy as anything, and he just stumbling like a walking zombie, and he gets to his door. And when he opened the door, you should have saw him. Sorry about this, Ursula. I'm so glad you didn't know what that was. I'm telling you, I was waiting in my office for that to happen. And when that happened, I looked out my door, and he was standing there like this. He wasn't moving, and his hand was shaking. You see? Oh, that was fun. Stumbling towards his door and just kind of falling into his office in the morning was routine, and he didn't give it a second thought. That's the best time to get people. And I can tell you that for the next couple months, he hesitated every time he went for his door handle, and he thought about the process of opening up the door and just what that process would involve. I want to kind of do the same thing without the firecrackers now, because they're done. This morning, I want us to look at the foundation of communion, the Passover supper from the Exodus story. I want us to take a really good look at it. And hopefully, for the months, Easter and after Easter, that we celebrate communion together, that we share this together, well, it won't just be a routine. But we'll understand the meaning behind it and have a little bit more, it just become a little more meaningful is what I'm going for. So the Exodus story, if you've watched your kids' movies, you'll know this one. God's people are in Egypt. They'd been in Egypt for 430-ish years. They started by ruling because Joseph was a pretty important person, but then Pharaohs came in. Sorry about the smell too, that firecracker. Pharaohs came in the line that didn't respect Joseph or his family, and the Hebrew people basically became slaves. They were brick builders. Their job in life was to make bricks for their Hebrew lords. One of the most important aspects of being a Pharaoh, one of the most important tasks was to build your tomb. Was to be big and bold enough that you had the biggest tomb after you died, and you need bricks to have tombs. So basically what the Hebrews were employed in doing were making tombs for Egyptian deities, which is just about the last thing that God's people would want to be doing. So Moses, and he's got a big backstory that we'll look at Sunday, but not today. We'll pick it up when he comes with Aaron, and he tells Pharaoh to let the people go. And Pharaoh says, are you kidding me? Like I'm going to make my own tomb. Like I'm going to build bricks for myself. We need these people. Take off. Take off, if you're a Bob and Doug fan. So, no one, okay. There's the laugh. It's early, I know. I thought the firecracker would kind of get us moving. They don't believe. Pharaoh's not going to let his people go. So Moses, the first thing he does is he transforms the Nile River into blood, and the fish die. And to us, it sounds gross and it sounds pretty spectacular, but to the Egyptians, it would have been worldview shaking because Egypt is centered on this one river, the Nile. After you leave the banks of the Nile, you have desert. All of your life, all of your crops, everything is dependent on that river. So they had many deities, but one of their deities was the crocodile that lived in that river. Because the Nile became the source of life. It was the fountain of life for them. It was the reason that they could exist as a nation. So what did God do? God said, yeah, you worship that? Pfft, gone. And so, of course, everyone repents. So, okay, I'll let them go. And then he goes to leave. And no, I'm not going to let them go anymore. And I don't know if you know the story, but there's a series of 10 plagues. And if you study them, you'll realize that almost every plague is an assault on one of the Egyptian gods. Almost everyone offends a certain Egyptian god. It's God's way of saying, it's not just, let's do something really gross and you might let my people go. It's, your gods are powerless. God is the only true God. So there's blood, and then there's a plague of frogs, of gnats, of flies. Then the livestock died. Then there were boils, so it actually affected the people. Then there was hail that destroyed the crops. Then there were locusts. And the last two plagues were darkness and death. Probably one of the most powerful Egyptian deities was the sun. They worshipped the sun. And what did God do? The second last plague? Made it dark over the land. As if to say, yeah, you think that's powerful? Watch this. And the last plague is what the Passover is based on. That's what we're going to read. So let's start in Exodus 12. I'm just going to read through the whole thing. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be for you the beginning of months. You're going to have a new year. It shall be the first month of the new year for you. Tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his nearest neighbor will take according to the number of persons, according to what each can eat, you shall make your count for the lamb. The lamb shall be without blemish, a male, 1 year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats, and you shall keep it until the 14th day of the month, when the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel will kill their lambs at twilight. All happened at the same time, same day. Then they shall take, and this is like where it turns into a PG sermon from a G sermon. Then they shall take some of the blood and put it on the doorposts and the lintel of the houses, which is the crossbar, of the houses in which they eat it. They shall eat the flesh that night, roasted on the fire with unleavened bread. Start to see where this is important for communion? With unleavened bread and bitter herbs they shall eat it. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled in water, but roasted on fire. It's had to be a barbecue. With its head and its legs and its inner parts. Yes, its inner parts. They had to creatively cook that thing. And you shall let none of it remain until the morning. Anything that remains until the morning, you will burn. In this manner you will eat it. With your belt fastened, with your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. And you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. They would typically wear longer robes in that day, and if they had to travel, what they would do is they would tuck their robes up and into their belt, because that way it wouldn't drag on the ground, right, when they're moving around and have to walk. And so that's what they're saying. They're saying, you're going to eat this meal like you're still moving, with your belt, with your robe tucked into your belt, ready to go. You're going to eat it prepared.
I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I will strike all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague will befall you or destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. This day will be for you a memorial day, and you will keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout generations, as a statute forever you will keep the feast.
Skipping down now to the 21st verse.
Then Moses called all the elders of Israel together and said to them, "Go select lambs for yourself according to your clans and kill the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood that is in the basin and touch the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. None of you shall go out of the door of his house until morning, for the Lord will pass through and strike the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to enter your houses to strike you. You will observe this rite as a statute for you and your sons forever. And when you come to the land the Lord will give you as he promised, you shall keep this service." So it was not something that ended, but it was something that continued. "And when your children say to you, 'What do you mean by this?' you shall say, 'It is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover. For he passed over the houses of the people in Israel, of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians, but he spared our houses.' So the people bowed their heads and worshipped. Then the people of Israel went and did so as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron." Well, here's what happened. At midnight, the Lord struck down the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive, who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of the livestock. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead. Then he summoned Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Go up out from among my people, both you and the people of Israel, and serve the Lord as you have said. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said. Be gone and bless me also."
And then one last section to read, and then we'll get to talking about it, is verse 43 and on.
"And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, 'This is the statute of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat of it, but every slave is bought for money, that's bought for money, may eat of it after you've circumcised him. No foreigner or hired servant may eat of it. It shall be eaten in one house. You shall not take any of the flesh outside the house. You will not break any of its bones.'" That's a curious little verse. "If the congregation, all the congregation of Israel will keep it. If a stranger shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to the Lord, let his males be circumcised. Then he may come near and keep it. He shall be as a native of the land, but no uncircumcised person will eat of it. There will be one law for native and for the stranger who sojourns among you." So the people of Israel did just as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. And on that very day, the Lord brought the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their hosts.
And that's where we're going to stop and get into. And I hope you didn't mind the long passage, but I really want that first Passover to sink in. I really want it to connect with you. I'm going to look at eight little elements of this Passover feast, eight things that jumped out about that first Passover. And the first is this: it marks the new year. They started by talking about that right at the beginning. This month is going to be the beginning of the new year for you. It's as if they were living a law according to the schedule of Egypt. And whenever Egypt would celebrate their new year, Israel would celebrate, because what else did they have? And God said, "I'm going to do something so amazingly spectacular." I don't know if bit of an, anyways, so amazingly spectacular that you're going to start your clocks according to this day. This is your new year. This is the day when new years begin. And you know what? That's not a bad idea. What do we do for New Year's? We get together, which is good.
I left the New Year's party this past year a little early because Donna's mom was up and she was looking after the kids, and we thought we should spend the New Year's with her. But what do? You sit on the couch and you have your choice. You can listen to Canadian hip-hop from Toronto, which is... Or you can flip over to, Niagara Falls. They always have Great Big Sea and other kind of folky bands on there, which is kind of fun. Usually they have some classic rockers, Kim Mitchell or something like that. Or you can go big budget and you can look at Times Square, Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's Eve, and you can catch the entertainment there. And what does North America do at New Year's? We watch a big ball. They say it drops, but it doesn't. It just glides down this post to the floor. What a silly tradition. Seriously, what'd you do for New Year's? I watched a big, shiny ball come slowly down a building, and it gets shinier every year. Israel was to celebrate the New Year because God set them free from slavery. Man, I know it's not practical to restart our clocks, but we should start celebrating the New Year at Easter, I'm telling you. Anyways, the New Year. Second thing they had to do was choose a lamb to sacrifice. This lamb had to be a male, and it had to be without blemish. That's important. We're going to see in a bit. It couldn't be a spotted, sick, weak lamb, because that's the temptation. When you're giving something to God, right? You're donating something to the church or donating something to the food bank. You don't think, oh man, this is tasty. It's going there. You look at your closet and you think, oh, that's been there 2 years. I'll give that to the food bank. It had to be a lamb that was without blemish. I'm kind of half sarcastic on that one because I've done that too. I'm trying to get over that and to give better gifts there. But the lamb had to be without blemish because you were offering it to God and it had to be the best. You couldn't get away with slipping in the sick ones. In that curious little phrase, you weren't to break any of the lamb's bones when you're barbecuing him. The third thing, and this is where it gets a little bit gross, but if we're going to understand communion, you have to understand this. They were to take this branch of this bunch of hyssop. Now, hyssop is, it's kind of like goldenrod. It's a wiry plant with a bunch of flowers on the top, and it's good for soaking up liquid. So it's like a really rustic ancient paintbrush is what it was. And they would take the hyssop, and they would dip it in the blood from the lamb that was sacrificed. They would smear it up and around the door. Kind of a bit of a gross thing to do, but it was an important thing. I just noticed, I don't know, and I didn't even plan this, but when I was reading Psalm 51, that Psalm of Repentance, cleanse me with hyssop and I'll be clean. In the original Exodus, the first Passover, Every male was kind of considered the priest of his house. And so the lambs were sacrificed right at the house, and it was all done there. But of course, as time went on and things got institutionalized by Jesus' day, this was done at the temple. And again, I'm not doing this to gross you out, but just to kind of grasp the magnitude of this. According to one historian back then, at a typical Passover feast in Jesus' day, there was over 200,000 lambs barbecued for the people. And they had to be sacrificed at twilight, at the end of the day. And they were all sacrificed in the temple in Jerusalem. We have no concept of what that was like. And that fed about 2 million people, because there was about 10 people to a lamb. And if your family was too small, you'd connect with another family and share the lamb amongst it, because you couldn't have any leftovers. Just imagine this altar in the center of the temple in Jerusalem. And if you read the accounts of it, it was like an assembly line. They had 2 hours from about 3 o'clock to about 5 o'clock to take care of 200,000 lambs. Lineups and lineups all the way around of priests and all the people that came there. It was an assembly line. You'd walk up, give their lamb, collect the blood, go home with your barbecue and your blood. And some of the blood, of course, was... first splashed up across the altar. And I know it's gross, but it was a very visual, smelly sort of ordeal. When it was sacrifice time, everyone knew it. It was a disgusting time. You see, sometimes I think we begin to think that the Passover meal was just a feast, But it was more than a feast. It was a sacrifice spread with hyssop. Sometimes I used to wonder, why did they spread it on their doors? Did God need directions? Was God going through the place going, oh, are my people in there or not? No, of course it's not like that. There was other plagues that differentiated between Israel and between Egypt. But what those were was, it was a sign. When you put the blood on your doorpost, you were visually in front of all the Egyptians saying, I'm a follower of God. It was a sign that you wore. What sort of signs do we wear today? Crosses? Often we have crosses. Sometimes we put fish on the back of our cars. And I have to encourage you, if you do that, drive nicely. Yeah. There's nothing... Anyways, one of the things that I thought I'd point out here is, and I don't understand, and I guess I used to, but it's the whole Christian t-shirt craze, where what people do is they take a Christian... They take a worldly logo, and they try to fit a Christian message into it, and they slap it on a t-shirt, and you can be proud and cool to wear it. So I put some of these up here, if we could watch them. There's Jesus died for my space in heaven, which is... Next one. Jesus meant to die for you, according to the Mountain Dew logo. Next one. God is my hero. Any Guitar Hero fans will know what that's about. Next one. His way. Subway. Next one. Jesus. It's just that easy. You know, the button and staples. Is there any more? Oh, yeah, the last one. Armed and ready. I used to wear shirts like that. And if you wear shirts like that, God bless you. It seems like a pretty silly way to be marked for God, though. How does God want us to be marked for him? I think he's a little bit more concerned with our actions and how we behave in this world rather than what we wear. But anyways, we'll leave it at that. The blood was spread. Number four, they had to be ready to leave. They made bread without leaven in it because think of what happened. This is the last plague. They ate this feast the one night, and the next morning they left. They left town. They took off. They were set free. And they left as soon as they were ready. It's the equivalent of you're going on a road trip. You stop off at a fast food restaurant and you think, should I eat this in the car? Should I eat it inside? Nah, we better eat this in the car. That's what this is. Eat it dressed up, ready to go. Number five, they were eating it to remember their suffering. They were to eat bitter herbs because they needed to remember the painful life of slavery that they had. And you know what? There's just a little point there that's important for us. It's worth remembering the difficult times in our life because our minds often filter those things out. I've been on 101 camping trips, and I don't remember the bugs. When you're on the trip, they can be horrible, and they can be a horrible nuisance. But when you look back, you remember the landscape. You remember your friends. You remember dunking the canoe. You remember all the fun things, but you don't remember the bugs. And our brains, they have this filter. When we look back on our life, we can forget some of the struggles that we've gone through. God wanted Israel to remember their struggles because it's what made them who they are. We need to remember as well. Number six, this was a holy meal. The Jewish people today celebrate a Seder meal. It is related, but it is something different. This was a holy meal. It was a sacrifice. And there's so many things that point to it being something special. They weren't allowed to keep the leftovers. Nothing I like better than leftovers. It's like you don't have to cook. You just open up the fridge, pop it in the microwave, and you're done. You couldn't keep this lamb as leftover. In fact, by the end of the night, if the tenny you didn't polish it off, you had to burn the rest of it because it was a holy meal to the Lord. Number seven, the feast was to be kept regularly, and it was to be taught to their children. It was something that had to continue. He instituted this feast of Passover so that they wouldn't forget what God did for them. And then finally, number eight, only covenant members partook of it. If you wonder all that weird bit I read about the end about being circumcised, that was the mark of being an Israelite. If you were part of God's people, you were circumcised. That's just the way it was. And so the rule for Passover was God doesn't care what ethnicity they were, but they had to be part of his covenant. in order to celebrate this Passover because it was really only meaningful to his people. So that's the first Passover. I want to look at communion now. We're going to be taking communion together very soon because it's very easy to forget, first of all, that Jesus was a Jewish person. We think of him as the first Christian rather than the ultimate Jew. But he really is the pinnacle of a Jewish person. Mark 14. The supper, the Last Supper, was a Passover meal. I'm just going to, you don't have to turn here if you want, don't want, but here's how it started. On the first day of unleavened bread, when they sacrificed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to Jesus, "Where will you have us go and prepare the Passover?" And he sent two of his disciples and said, "Go into a city, and a man carrying a water jar will meet you. Follow him, and when he enters, say to the man of the house, 'My teacher says, where is my guest room that I might eat the Passover with my disciples?'" The Lord's Supper, the one that we celebrate every time we take communion together, it started out as a Passover meal. It started out as this bloody mess of a thing where people remembered it. The Jesus' disciples would have taken a lamb. They would have went to the temple. They would have come back with it. They would have done the procedure, and they would have expected it to be a typical Passover meal, but it was anything other than typical. Instead of Jesus starting the Passover meal by talking about Exodus, "Remember, we were in slavery and our God set us free," he started talking about his own suffering and his own death that would come. Instead of explaining the meaning of the flesh of the Passover lamb, what the lamb represents, what the unleavened bread represents, what the bitter herbs represented, Jesus picked up some wine and some bread and said, "No, this is the body that matters. This is my body." He was taking the whole theme of Passover and reinterpreting it, redoing it for his followers. And so I'm going to go quick with this because I want to take the bulk of the rest of our time just celebrating communion together, but a whirlwind tour through those eight elements with Jesus in mind. First of all, it's the new year. And I said it before, Easter should be the start of our year as a church, as a people, because Easter is the time we remember God setting us free from slavery. There had to be a lamb to sacrifice, and we know that Jesus was that lamb. Jesus was a lamb. He was a male. He was without blemish. He was morally flawless. Hebrews 4:15 says, he was in every way just like us, except without sin. There was no mark on his body. He became, essentially, the Passover lamb. There's this little detail that the gospel writers include. It says, typically, when criminals were crucified, after a certain amount of time, they would put them out of their misery by breaking their legs so they couldn't push their body up and breathe and they would suffocate. There's this little detail that all the gospel authors include. It's that when they came around to Jesus, he was dead and they didn't need to break a bone in his body. Mm-hmm. Passover lamb, you shall not break a bone in his body. Paul went so far as to say in Corinthians that Christ, our Passover lamb, has been slain. Jesus became the Passover lamb for us. The blood, spread the blood. Sometimes I think, we have this hymn, "There is a fountain filled with blood." It's a beautiful hymn. But imagine for the first time, you have no history of Christianity at all. You go into church for the first time and there's a bunch of people with half smiles on their face in worship singing, "There's a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins. And you filthy sinners that are plunged beneath that bloody fountain lose all your guilty stains." Check, please. You know what I mean? I have a pretty wide taste in music, as Ben would attest, and that sounds more like a death metal song than a hymn to me. But the fact remains that it was a bloody ordeal when the Passover lamb was sacrificed, and the New Testament goes to great pains to say it is by Jesus' blood, by his death, that we are set free.
I wanted to read a bit from Romans chapter 5, where Paul picks up on this. Romans 5, 6 to 9. For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a very good person someone might choose to die. But God demonstrates his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since then, and this is the point, we have been justified. We have been saved. We have been delivered. We have been freed. Since we have been justified by his blood. It's a big section. We could go into a lot more. The fact remains that it's Jesus' blood, the fact that he died for us, that has set us free. Just as it was the blood of the sacrifice of the Passover lamb smeared on the doorposts of the ancient Israelites that set them free back then. It set them free from Egypt. It's Jesus' blood that sets us free from sin today. The first Passover, they had to eat it ready to go because they were leaving the next day. Salvation came quickly. And think about the Lord's Supper, the last supper he spent with the disciples. What happened? Before the supper was even done, before the last cup was drank, they left. He was taken, tried, and killed. Immediately it happened, ready to go. They were to eat bitter herbs to remember the suffering that they were under. And it is good for us not just to remember our own tough times in our life. I talked about that, the times that we've struggled, because it made us who we are. But we also need to take time to remember what Jesus went through for us. Now, I know full well that it's a tactic, and I've had it used on me. Oftentimes, people who preach to youth will go into gruesome detail about every little element of the crucifixion and everything that would happen. But shock value isn't spirituality, and I'm going to leave this to you. This season of Lent, approaching Easter, read the gospel stories right at the end. Read what Jesus went through and remember what he suffered for us. It was a holy meal. It started as a sacrifice, but the Passover sacrifice was not complete until all the lamb was eaten. And it's the same with us. Our new life began when Jesus was killed. But our new life is not over until that final feast happens that we anticipate by all of our feasts here. It's a holy meal. We're to keep it regularly. That's why Paul said, as often as you do it in remembrance of me. Churches have different traditions. Roman Catholic Church keeps it every week. That's why they come together. We keep it every month. We find it's a good trade-off between becoming so familiar it's boring, but still being something special. Some churches keep it quarterly. Some churches keep it annually. But we're to keep it regularly because we have to keep bringing back to our mind the reason we're together. It's because Jesus died for us. And finally, just as Passover was only for covenant members, people who were circumcised, because it would make no sense to anyone else, so communion is only for believers. Because, quite frankly, if you're not a believer, it wouldn't make that much sense to you. It wouldn't have that much meaning because we together are taking what representations of Jesus' blood and Jesus' body and thanking him for setting us free. Jesus just didn't decide to have a good supper before he died. He decided to have a Passover meal. And he changed, he tweaked, he modified that Passover meal so that his disciples would be able to continue it on and carry it on from that time forth. And that's what we do every first of every month. When we come together, we celebrate Jesus' modified Passover meal. Oh, one last note about the hyssop. You know, the hyssop was used to smear the blood on the doors back in Egypt. You know, the psalmist wrote, "Cleanse me with hyssop, and I will be clean." You know, hyssop makes an appearance in the crucifixion as well. By the time Jesus was celebrating this Passover feast, there was typically 4 glasses of wine drunk at different times during the festival, during the supper. But we don't have a record of all those glasses of wine being consumed. We have some of, there's some hints to suggest that the beginnings were. But then Jesus says this curious thing, I will not drink wine again until I drink it in my Father's kingdom. I'm not going to complete this Passover yet. And what does Jesus do? He goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, prays, he's betrayed by his followers, he's brought before Pilate, he's brought before the high priest, and taken to Pilate, he's unjustly accused, he's put on trial, the people condemn him, he's beaten up, he's bruised, he's crucified. And before you would go through all of that, it was a small mercy to condemn criminals to offer them a bit of strong drink, to kind of knock away a bit of the suffering that they were feeling. Jesus turned that drink down. Jesus needed to go through it with a clear mind. But at the end, just before he died, they took hyssop and put some like sour vinegar, some strong pungent alcohol, wine, a fourth cup if you will, and passed it up to him. And he drank it because the Passover was done. The sacrifice was done. It was accomplished. It was through. So what I want to do now, so I'll ask the communion attendants to come on forward and distribute the emblems. I've talked enough about communion not have to give you another speech right now, but if you're a believer, feel free. You're welcome to participate with us. But of course, there's no obligation. If you feel uncomfortable, you don't have to as well. But we're going to worship God together. We're going to take communion together, and then we're going to take a little bit more time to worship him before we leave. Because Christ, our Passover lamb, has been slain.